This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Joy 94.9 presents Absolutely Everybody, sponsored by and presented by Anecto, the People Network. Absolutely Everybody, only on Joy 94.9.
We've got the wonderful Paulette Whitten, who's the Aboriginal Liaison Officer for Anecto in New South Wales. Welcome, Paulette.
Thank you very much.
And what have you been up to already? I bet you've got a busy week coming up.
Yes, it has sort of been a little bit busy so far, and with this week being home from today. National Reconciliation Week, and of course yesterday's commemorations of Sorry Day as well. So it is a sort of busy week, although for the Aboriginal community. Although I must say that National Reconciliation Week is more involved with getting the white community involved, with connecting with Aboriginal communities, rather than Aboriginal communities holding their own National Reconciliation Week event. But,
yeah.
But nevertheless, it is a busy a week around the country.
Mm. Yeah, and that was one of the things, you know, as I was looking through to see, okay, what's going to be on, you know, for Reconciliation Week? Who's doing what? And I got on, it's been really quiet as far as the lead up to Reconciliation Week this year, and I'm not sure why that is, but yeah, I realised, you know, actually I shouldn't be going to my usual places that are Aboriginal organisations, because this is actually about white fellas and as well, you know, being part of the process and saying, well, yeah, hello, this is what we're putting on, this is what, you know, what we want to engage in and be part of. So yeah, between 27th of May and the 3rd of June, we've got, is it National Reconciliation Week is, oh, actually, I think it's up to the 29th. Is that right? What dates have we got this year?
No, the dates for National Reconciliation Week are always the same, and that is from the 27th of May, which is today, till the 3rd of June, and that is the set dates for National Reconciliation Week each year. And if you don't know why that is, it's because those dates highlight two very significant historical events, and they are the anniversaries of the 1967 referendum and the Mabo judgment.
Yeah.
And so, like today, the 27th of May, is the anniversary of Australia's most successful referendum, which is the 1967 referendum, that saw, at that time, over 90% of Australians vote to give the Commonwealth the power to make laws for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, and also to recognise our peoples in the national census. And so until 1967, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were not officially recognised in the national census.
I know, and so, I mean, so recently. And before that, am I right that Aboriginal people were actually collected in the census under flora and fauna?
That's pretty much, we didn't actually have a place in the census at all.
Yeah.
But Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were considered to be flora and fauna.
Outrageous. Yeah. And that overwhelming majority of Australians who said, yeah, absolutely, you know, this is, you know, this is crazy, let's change that. And then it got to the 3rd of June 1992. What's that landmark decision around?
Yep, the 3rd of June, as some people may know, back in 1992 was the High Court of Australia handed down the Mabo decision, which was legally recognising that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples have a exceptional special connection to the land pre-colonisation that still exists today. And so a lot of people may know the Mabo judgment or have heard about native title. Well, the Mabo judgment gave birth to the native title system. So that's the other significant date of Reconciliation Week, the 3rd of June, which hails back to the Mabo judgment, which was handed down in 1992.
Yeah, and we've still got some of the oldest rock art and culturally significant sites that are under threat in places where people are wanting to mine and do all sorts of things.
Yes, absolutely. Aboriginal cultural heritage is always under threat, even when you want to construct a new road, a new freeway, you know, because a lot of those freeways and things that you drive on these days have actually either destroyed Aboriginal cultural heritage sites or, you know, some of those sites that those roads go through have, you know, they've agreed with the Aboriginal community to get the Aboriginal community to move them to another site so that, you know, but it's not on the original site.
Yeah.
So so everyday things that we take for granted in mainstream Australian life, yeah, there's been a lot of cultural heritage damage already. And then you've got things that are destructive, like mining as well, and those sorts of things on Aboriginal country.
And there's a lot of sites people would walk past every day that they wouldn't necessarily know is kind of significant. You know, from the conversations I've had with people talking about, you know, well, you've got to be careful that, you know, you don't move those stones, you don't move that area, that's significant. You're like, really? Like, wow.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, and that's you know, correct, and there's different things in different places, and even through you know, moving through suburbs of whether it be Melbourne or Sydney, where I'm based, you know, there's Aboriginal heritage all around you, even in the suburbs. Names and that so forth. So there's a lot of cultural heritage around. It's just that you've got to stop and think and educate and learn about these things. Yeah, and I think it's a lot of people would say, well, why do we have to learn about it? And I think the answer to that question is that this country always was and always will be Aboriginal land, and so everything that we develop on this country, you need to think about the First Peoples and how you can integrate that as part of your daily life.
And some other countries seem to have done that really well, like Native American culture in the US is really highly respected and elders are engaged on a lot of topics, and same with New Zealand, and I don't know. Do we have that same level of consultation and collaboration, do you think?
I think it's something that we're striving for. We sort of maybe have bases for it, but I don't think it's as strong as in other countries. Example for Aotearoa, as you said, New Zealand. You know, I think their peoples are more visible over there, and of course they have the Waitangi Treaty, which we don't have a treaty in this country that I heard you alluding to in your introduction.
Yeah.
There is one, and I think some of those bases, that's a basis that is required, I think, to move forward in consultations, and I don't think consultations are done enough as well in this country, and sort of, you know, people's attitudes and I guess not everyone will say that they have a racist bone in their body, but but the ignorance breeds racism. So if you're ignorant about something, then, you know, your level of knowledge won't be as good, and it can be seen as racist there as well. But I think it's just about educating yourself and connecting with people. I mean, there's been research done in this country to say that many Australians have never come into contact with an Aboriginal person.
I find that amazing.
I find that amazing as well.
Yeah, right. Wow.
But I think part of that issue is that people don't recognise who is an Aboriginal person.
Yeah.
And the thinking about what an Aboriginal person looks like.
Yeah, right.
And that as well. And I think that the idea goes back to the Aboriginal person, a dark-skinned a person wearing a lap, standing on one leg with a spear.
Yeah.
It's such an ancient view. It's part of our traditional culture, obviously.
Yeah, and sure.
But Aboriginal people don't look like that all around the country. We all look different. We come in all different shapes, sizes and colours.
Yeah, and it'd be like going, oh, you know what those white people look like? They look like they're... in those bustles, you know, the women wear bustles and lovely 18th century gear and those lovely head, you know, gears, you know, oh, that's what white people look like, you know, and people go, don't be stupid. Same thing, you know, in the LGBTIQ community, you know, it's the same thing with gender. People will say, oh, I've never met a lesbian, oh, I've never met a trans person, oh, I've never met, because of the perception.
Chances are you just don't know you have.
Yeah.
And exactly. Chances are that you've just walked past, ten Aboriginal people and you wouldn't even know.
It's about training to not make those assumptions about people and see people as people and start a conversation rather than starting a conversation about race or anything. Just start a conversation with, hey, hi, how are you?
How you doing? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And go from there. It's not complicated.
Exactly. And that's a great base, and I think it's just the conversations that we need to have on a more regular basis, as you say.
Well, will you hang around with us, Paulette? Because we want to talk a bit about the Conchilla Boys and what Anecto's doing, and you know, in this space of inclusion, but also. There's a film festival at the moment in Melbourne, the St Kilda Film Festival, and there's a wonderful piece about the Conchilla Boys home that has made it to the music video section of the finals there. So we're pretty impressed with that.
This is Absolutely Everybody on Joy 94.9. Proudly sponsored by
Anecto. And we are on the Wurundjeri lands of the Kulin Nation, and we're with someone from Koori country over in New South Wales. I think that's right. Paulette, you're part of the Koori Nation that's over there?
Yeah, I actually work and live on the Koori, on the nation of the Darug people. The Darug people are the traditional owners of the Sydney area.
Oh,
although some groups say that it's the Eora Nation, so I acknowledge both the Eora and Darug peoples of Sydney. I've been born and lived on this country for all my life, basically.
Yeah, right.
But most of it, except for a couple of times when I've left the state. But I am a Yeraliai and Gamilaroi woman from northwest New South Wales myself, which is country out in Gadooga, which is past Lightning Ridge in the outback of New South Wales.
Yeah, beautiful.
And over across the border as well, and also on my other side, Gamilaroi from the town of Coonabarabran and Burrabadee Mission, and my father was also. Grew up in the notorious Conchilla Boys home, well as part of the Stolen Generation. So I have those connections as well as part of my heritage.
Wow. So you have a direct connection to understanding the impacts of that Stolen Generation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My father is a product of the Stolen Generations, and as such, those issues have affected and touched my life as well, my entire childhood and adult life there as well. So, and I have a strong connection to the Conchilla Boys Home mob as well. I consider them my uncles.
Yeah, they've created a very tight bond, those boys, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. Yes. And I think regardless of whether it's Conchilla or Cootamundra or Bomaderry or elsewhere, you'll find a strong connection between those who grew up together, and that's pretty much the only family that they've ever had, really, from those kids that were taken from their families at such early ages and in their formative years, and that's where you form all those tight bonds, and it's with each other rather than their own biological families.
Yeah. What's the impact of that?
As a child of a Conchilla man that has its broken bonds with the biological family that you should have those close family ties with. My father grew up not knowing that he had sisters, for example.
Oh, wow.
And found out after he was exited the home that he actually had two sisters. He grew up with his twin brother, so they just knew that they had each other.
Right.
And they knew that they had a mum, and that was about it. So, you know, you're constantly on the search for family. Bonds are broken. You're like strangers. So my aunties were like strangers.
Yeah, right, of course.
So that's number one. And then you've got the effects of the treatment of my dad in Conchilla Boys Home. And so which means the inability to know how to be a father, the inability to communicate, as people take for granted, I think, as well. And the emotional attachments are a lot really not there. So it's, it really affects the growing up of a child when you have a father there, but it's sort of not there in another way. I'm not sure how to describe it.
Yes, it sounds like an emotional absence, like physically there, but emotionally not able to be there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, something like that. And, so that's a tiny bit of an insight into what it's like for the next generation. And then you carry, you know, also that anger as well. You know, why did this have to happen?
Yeah.
You know, I as a child gave the Aboriginal Protection Board and Welfare Board, who removed, you know, these kids like my dad and my dad as well, you know, the benefit of the doubt that they didn't know that my dad had family, because, you know, people were constantly saying that, you know, they had family members who had requested that they had take care of the children, but they were often denied. And I thought, well, they probably wouldn't have known about my dad's family, but when I was able to access records, I found that was not true.
But they did.
That there was family members. There was that had several family members who had asked to take care of the boys, they were denied.
That's outrageous. Wow.
That, you know, and a letter from one of my aunties to the board asking for a visit to see her sister.
Yeah, not unreasonable.
And that was denied.
On what grounds?
It was denied on that the other sister is already located in another family, and it would be upsetting of her if she was to meet, you know, the other sister.
People making decisions on behalf of people's lives. It's just so devastating.
Yeah, exactly. And then when my dad was about to leave the boys' home, there was a letter to say that his auntie was at Walgett, so they were sending them over to Walgett. So why take them away and then send them back to the family that they don't know?
Yeah, like go and live with a stranger, go and live with these people up here.
Yeah, so it's sort of really weird, you know, that they did know where the family was, but their plan was to just break those family ties. And a lot of people don't believe that it's whitewashing, but that's pretty much what it is. Boys like my dad were told in the home that they weren't Aboriginal, that they were just darker skinned.
Really?
There's a song that was written by one of the Kinchel boys, Uncle Roy Reed, called Why, and that's exactly what he was told and says in the song. You know, they weren't Aboriginal, they were just darker than the other kids.
Yeah, just that.
So they were denying their Aboriginality, and it was basically whitewashing. So it's a very tragic part of our history should never be forgotten.
And I think that connects back, doesn't it, to then, you know, in 2008 when the apology from Kevin Rudd came, you know, how what that actually means to Aboriginal people, because white people have no idea what that really means apart from... Oh, isn't that good that there's been an acknowledgement? I mean, that doesn't heal people and change everything. But, you know, from the Aboriginal perspective of the apology in 2008, what was that like?
Well, in the lead up to that apology in 2008, I actually thought it was not going to be any of use at all.
Yeah.
But when it did happen, I actually cried when Kevin Rudd apologised.
So did I.
And it was like an acknowledgement of what did happen.
Yeah.
Because of growing up, and because all the boys were all separated, so again they went for 20 odd years without seeing each other, unless they run into each other at some point. But so we always felt isolated and felt like we were the only ones that went through this.
Yeah.
And until we got back together in 2002 and the Kinchela Boys Home men were reunited, that was when I was able to let go of some of the anger that I held towards my dad and his twin brother.
Mm.
And I was able to understand that we weren't the only family this happened to.
Yeah.
And then I've been on my journey, I guess, healing. They call it a journey of healing since then, so... So it's helped with a lot of the anger issues and the resentment that has sort of built up over the years, and I think it's created a closer bond between myself and my dad as well.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. I don't imagine that's necessarily for everyone, that everyone's at your, you know, stage, of course. But
no, not every Kintyre boy and their family member was there at the time, and so it's an ongoing process. And yeah. There was only a small amount of Kintyre boys back then, and which has grown since, you know, people have joined the journey, I guess, and joined with the Kintyre boys home, creating their own corporation as well, and trying to look after the needs and of the men and their families as well. So as that grows, so does the number of Kintyre boys home men and their families joining the group and joining the journey as well. And it's been, you know, some of the men can't come up to that place where the actual site of the old home, you know, they can't go there. They can't open those gates.
Yeah, just too painful.
Just too painful, yes.
Yeah.
And even though it looks different these days, but there's still that pain that exists, and that they haven't, that there hasn't been that healing.
Yeah. And I guess there's, you know, it puts a lot of pieces of the pie together when you start thinking about how that impacts on the families today, that those men didn't have inheritances, you know, to pass on to their families, and didn't necessarily have the ability to participate. They weren't set up to participate in community and society like a lot of other people had a head start with just a family unit, you know, to back them up when the times were tough. And we all go through tough times. But what amazing survivors those men.
Yeah, they are survivors, and they are survivors, and that's pretty much the only thing that Kintyre Boys Home taught them. They were they had to survive or be killed, basically.
Yeah.
And that's the attitude and, you know, the mentality that they came out of the homes with, I think. And and they are survivors, absolute survivors. And I lost my train of thought there where I was going with that now.
Well, you know, your perspective brings to me too is just how incredibly resilient you and your family and the other families who have silently kind of gone through a lot of this process are still going through it now, and that the rest of Australians have no idea of just that impact, you know, of what such a different life is like. And I mean, thank you so much for sharing your side of that story too, because it is such an insight. And
I was thinking about it the other day, and it's like the men were ripped of their soul as boys, because as boys they entered that Kintyre Boys Home gate and they were stripped of their identity straight away. They were given a number which was stamped on their clothing and any other personal items. And my dad's number was 31, and they've carried that from that day to this, and will carry that to their deathbed as well. And you ask all the men, and they still remember the number
that they
were stamped with. And that's the sort of like prisoner of war mentality.
It is.
As well, that they grew up with. So they were stripped of their identity from day one. They weren't, you know, allowed to be addressed by their name. It was by their number.
Wow.
They were abused and mistreated quite a lot in this particular home.
Yeah.
Different people will have different stories, and I'll let them share them,
of course,
as they feel they want to. It was a huge impact on the boys themselves, and then you've got that trauma that is carried on to the next generation. And I was thinking about it the other day, and it's a bit like a kiwi fruit, if you like. Then you're taking it, you're spooning out all the flesh, and you leave nothing but the skin on the outside when you eat a kiwi fruit. And that's sort of a little bit of what it's like. You've got an empty shell of these men, and they're passing that empty shell on to their next generation.
Yeah, it's post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, you know, there's no other way to really frame it except, you know, I guess people would understand, people coming back from war, that's what these, you know, men came back to, you know, is they were trying to be husbands and fathers with post-traumatic stress. And I thank God there are services as well that are out there that can assist and work with some of those men.
Yes, and ANECTO has formed a great partnership with the Kintyre Boys Home Aboriginal Corporation, so they're helping to, you know, assist the corporation help the men and their families as well. So I'm really pleased to see that Enecto has formed that relationship with that part of the community.
Mm. And if you are listening and you're thinking, hey, yeah, look, it's time for me to, you know, maybe make a connection and connect through, you know, enecto.org.au, you can make a connection through that way. The video for the boys' home is up there. Again, a warning if you are, you know, a survivor of or know someone who has experienced the Stolen Generation, either directly or indirectly, that will have it has a huge impact on me, and I'm so removed from that experience. But it is a wonderful video. When it comes to actual support, there's Reconciliation Australia actually has some different links on their site, but we'll also bring you, of course, if you've been affected up to now, you can call 1300 1114 and speak to someone on Lifeline, because there's always someone there that's actually there to answer the phone. But we'll also put up some other support lines. Paulette, there's so much. Paulette, we'll have to call you back at some stage, because there's so many things to talk about, and there's so many joyful things to talk about too. You know, when it comes to resilience, I think if anything, I realise is that I can learn so much more from my Aboriginal brothers and sisters around resilience and how to get up and face another day. So, thanks so much for your time.
No worries. And just on the impact of resilience, the song that you played there was written by was performed by Mark Ferris, but also written by Uncle Ian Crow Lowe, number 41 from Kinchula Boys Home. And he's used poetry as his form of dealing with his pain from his years at KBH, and has now been able to form that relationship with Mark, who's put that into a song. So and that's helping Uncle Crow's resilience and healing as well.
Beautiful.
And I'd also like to acknowledge, before I go, the traditional owners, the Kulin Nation, the Wurundjeri people, and our LGBTI community members who may be listening as well. And, and if you're part of the Stolen Generation, then stay strong.
Oh, thank you so much. Couldn't have said it any better. You're on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.